You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 351, The Good News of the Return of the King. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike. I have a feeling this is going to be one of your favorite episodes.
Yeah, it's one of those geek out episodes. You know, yeah, what can I say? Yeah, we're gonna have Michael Jahofsky on, who has written a book about Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, and the good news, and again, just the way the book overlaps with biblical content, the gospel, Jesus, and you know, Michael has read Unseen Realm and a few of my other books, and you know, I'm quoted in this book, and he actually does interact with the content a good bit. So Michael was recommended by Lewis Marcos, and I think this will be fun.
All right. And we have a link on the nakedbiblepodcast.com website. So go there, get the coupon code, and get the link so you could go get this book. And without Micah, why don't we just get into it?
All right, let's do that. Well, we're excited to have Michael Jahofsky on with us here on the Naked Bible Podcast. Now, for those of you who you could probably guess, Michael was recommended, and his book that we're going to talk about and talk through was recommended by Lewis Marcos, which he should need no introduction to the Naked Bible Podcast audience. We've spent a previous episode talking about how Lewis, you know, saw parts of, you know, the Lord of the Rings worldview and cosmology connecting to my book, The Unseen Realm. And then we had a follow-up episode where we talked about Milton. We're going to return to Lord of the Rings today with Michael Jahofsky, again, at Lewis's recommendation. And I've read the book. So again, this stuff, you know, pardon me for geeking out a little bit. This stuff, you know, fascinates me because I am a Tolkien fan, but you know, I wasn't like consulting Tolkien when, you know, I was doing my own work in biblical studies, but you know, the cosmological connections are just fascinating to me. So today we're going to talk with Michael about his book, The Good News of the Return of the King. And the subtitle is The Gospel in Middle Earth. So Michael, I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself a little bit first. Just tell us, you know, who you are, the academic stuff, you know, your degree, where you teach, what you teach, that sort of thing.
Well, Dr. Heiser, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. So I'm a humanities professor currently at St. Pete College in Clearwater now. I've just moved campuses, as a matter of fact. I've been there for 10 years. Previously, I was at USF for graduate school. I did a master's in humanities. So I'm an interdisciplinary guy for what I feel is a very interdisciplinary you know, book. And in fact, yep. I was asked on a previous interview about that. And I said, yeah, you know, it shows the humanities training. Prior to that, I was at UCF. So I'm a Florida kid. I grew up here. And even though living around the world, I got my degree as an undergrad at UCF. I got a classical humanities degree. I focused a lot on Alexander the Great's Hellenistic Empire. And then I got a degree in history, where I kind of combined those two. So I've got the 3 degrees. I've been teaching 10 years. I've done 2 study abroad trips with St. Petersburg College to Israel in 2014 and in 2016. My God, it's been 4 years already. So my background is interdisciplinary. I try to specialize these days in religion and philosophy and mythology, but I've got a background as well as in history, as I said. And I've, you know, also a big nerd, but I've specialized in Greek and Roman and Jewish civilizations in particular.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, obviously our audience has not, you know, read the book. They're just getting introduced to it. And it is interdisciplinary. I mean, how could it not be, really, you know?
Right, exactly.
If you have your head into Tolkien and you know, track on just some of the meta-narrative themes. I mean, you can't just stay in one place. So that's really understandable. What I want to track on today, it will become evident, you know, to our audience, but we're essentially going to go through the book chapter by chapter, because I think a sort of a chapter / thematic, you know, approach will probably make what you're trying to do a little bit clearer. Mm-hmm. But again, before we jump into the actual content, I'd like you to summarize your journey This is something I'd like you to just sort of summarize what you have at the very beginning of the book. You know, when you start out, the year 2001 was an important one for me, and you know, just sort of what, you know, what your path was and how it sort of wound up here.
Yeah. Speaking of path, I use C.S. Lewis's essay, I think Christianity and Culture, which is in one of those essay compilations, his phrase, my road into Jerusalem, to describe my journey, which I was just asked to do a few months ago with some students. And, you know, it's been a winding one. I know all Christians have different paths. Mine has been kind of disclosed more clearly to me recently as things have come together in my life. But yeah, 2001 is really where the story starts, although I should just note that I began as a Catholic kid in a Catholic family. I was baptized, received First Communion. I didn't do confirmation, though, and that's because my folks got divorced. I went on a hiatus, not really being a Christian until about 2001, when we moved into, you know, the milk Christianity, the what we didn't know at the time, prosperity gospel stuff. My mom kind of found Christ again after a car accident, which I didn't mention in the book, but she kind of brought me to Christ again, but through Protestantism in 2001. And this was also the year, as you know, that the Fellowship of the Ring with Peter Jackson came out in December. And a few months prior to that, starting in the summer, I think it was, my brother started reading the Fellowship to me. I remember vividly him, you know, kind of reading it up to the time of the release. We didn't finish it, but we, you know, finished it after the movie came out. And I did not realize until about 10 years after, about 2010-11, that there was a connection between rediscovering Christianity, although in a different form, and reading The Lord of the Rings. Now, the thing that got me was reading N.T. Wright, who I'm sure needs no introduction to biblical scholars, and his book, Simply Jesus, which I think came out that year. And I remember reading it in bed and thinking, wow, this sounds familiar. Where have I heard this? I said, you know, this is an exciting way to look at the Bible. I wish somebody had taught me this. God becoming king. Why does that remind me of, oh yes, that's The Lord of the Rings for me. And I made this connection. And from there on out, I started journaling and getting some ideas. And gradually it's, you know, the rest of the preface in the book and some of the intro tells the story. But those were the key points for me.
Yeah. It's interesting. You know, I didn't know it either at the time, but my second, you know, sort of introduction to anything, you know, overtly, and I can't even use that word overtly Christian, was when I was nine was really my first exposure to anything that we would call, you know, serious, you know, Christianity. Mm-hmm. And that was through a neighbor. But then the next year, actually the same year in school, I had a teacher. It's the only year she ever taught. I was in fourth grade and she read us The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You know, and yeah, you don't know it at the time, but then when you know you're a few years removed and you start, you know, getting exposed to biblical stuff, a lot of that stuff starts to sound familiar.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Lewis is more overt in, you know, in that regard.
I
understand completely. Now, yeah, as far as your purpose for the book, I'm going to read a little bit of what you have here on the purpose and ask you to comment on it.
Sure.
You wrote here, I wrote this book because I wanted to share how The Lord of the Rings as Christian literature has helped me understand Christianity better. Let me be clear. This is not because The Lord of the Rings is a carbon copy of the story we can read in the Bible. Instead, it feels like an extension of the biblical story. Mm. I realize many books on this subject already exist, but I believe that I have uncovered something very special and worth reading about, and that is The Lord of the Rings is a parable about what Jesus' parables are about, which is the very story of reality itself. And then you go on to say, parables are comparative narratives that bring together the mundane and the transcendent. I actually like the way you put that. The abstract and concrete, they are imaginative stories that re-mythologize and re-enchant reality by putting the transcendence back into the world that the modern rational materialistic worldview has taken out of it. Parables as a form of mythology show us that truth is not narrowly defined by what human reason, the senses, and science can prove. My argument in this book is that in The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien has given us a parable of the gospel that not only can restore our understanding and appreciation of Jesus' parables and the Bible, but can also show us how parables can re-enchant reality. Mm-hmm. I'm going to stop there. To this audience, you're going to find a friendly audience to the idea of, you know, we need to re-mythologize and re-enchant, the church and our approach to the Bible.
Oh, yes.
Because again, my sort of bread and butter has been, we ought to be reading, scripture through the ancient eyes of the people, who wrote it, thousands mm-hmm. of years ago, and they were predisposed naturally to a very supernatural, worldview, and we are not.
That's right.
So, you're going to find a friendly audience for that, but could you just, comment a little bit about, what I just read and the purpose behind it?
Well, there's a lot of really great stuff there to comment on, but the first thing I'd like to point out is what I mean by an extension of the biblical story. So what I try to make the case in the book that, Jesus's parables can open up even a greater understanding of what we might be missing about the Christian worldview. But here, The Lord of the Rings is Christian literature, as a parabolic novel can extend and broaden and show us a more capacious view of the universe through Christian eyes. And in a sense, what I'm saying is, as a friend of Tolkien's had said, Robert Murray, who was a confidant of his, that the Lord of the Rings stands as a parable of the kingdom, he thought. And I think he's right. And this is somebody that knew Tolkien very well. And mm-hmm. So that's the first point. And so I don't mean that it, literally repeats themes, characters, et cetera, in the Bible, like I said, carbon copy. The Lord of the Rings is not about the Bible. It's about what the Bible is about and about what Jesus's parables are about, which is another way of saying the same thing. And so that would be the second point, that they're in both of these stories, that is in the Bible and in the Lord of the Rings, I think we see the same meta-narrative, which is, as you know, tied to the term mythos. At least mm-hmm. that's how scholars have kind of connecting it. And so that's what I'm saying there is that, no, this is not a strict, what Tolkien called in his letters, a conscious and intentional allegory, which was the only kind, we'll talk about this, but the only kind that he disliked. Mm-hmm. It is about what the biblical story is about. And I'm saying that is the story of everything, which is in keeping with what people are saying today. And then the rest of that is really just, and we'll get into this. I know you've asked me to, go over this with you about the book, parables, and we'll get into some technical elements mm-hmm. there about what they are as a form of literature, or as they say, a form of mythology. So I'll say more on that later, but it's a special kind of story, I think, and particularly Jesus's way of telling parables, very special,
mm-hmm.
very powerful.
Well, the mythic terminology, I think, is important, especially if they're, we get new listeners all the time, and so we mm-hmm. need to unpack that a little bit. I mean, because when some ears hear that, they think, if you're using the word myth mm-hmm. of, something in the Bible, that means you don't think it's true. When actually, mm-hmm. what we're saying by that term is not, no, it's actually more true than you think.
Yeah.
So and it sounds odd, but, mm-hmm. but I mean, for me, I've been working on something, a project here at work where next year I'm going to be doing a class that includes an element of the discussion about the problem of biblical historicity. And so if you think about it this way, if you had, two choices to make, and on the left-hand side, here's a historical narrative where everything is completely precise. Mm-hmm. Everything that's mentioned has been fact-checked. Mm-hmm. Everything has multiple source, source derivation here. Everything is just what you'd want it to be. But that historical tale completely excludes and dismisses and, in fact, denies mm-hmm. the notion that God or any supernatural reality exists and has any part to play. So that's door number one.
Mm-hmm.
Door number two is you have a historical narrative that isn't precise, that, sometimes what it claims really only has one source, that, the thing that you're reading that claims it, there's only one source. And so we have gaps, in our knowledge and understanding. It's incomplete, but mm-hmm. it acknowledges the reality of God and the supernatural having a role to play in mm-hmm. what happened. So the question is, mm-hmm. which one of those doors, door number one, or door number two is more true.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
We as moderns, you know, it's like, you know, as modern and Christian, you know, we're like, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, that door number one, that's history. But then when you get to just divorcing all of it from providence, or it's like, oh, wait a minute, that doesn't feel right. But then you go to door number two, and it's imperfect, you know, of what you'd want it to be, but it's actually more complete.
Exactly.
You know, it includes all of the reality elements that need to be there. And the surprise is that door number two is the Bible.
That's right.
Yeah. Door number two is the Bible. It is a selective book. It is not exhaustive and complete in all its details. Some of the things it says are only said there, but it actually gives you a more real, a more true representation of the way reality really is. And that's what we're talking about with myth and mythos. So I think people just need to understand, you know, what that terminology means, not only in this discussion, but, you know, broadly academics, when they would have this discussion, they're going to know this a little bit sort of intuitively.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, the public doesn't necessarily know that.
No. My experience as an educator, I'm sure you have the same one, that it's quite the contrary. They're very unfamiliar. And it's the modern definition of myth, which, you know, I can speak to, or you've already done it, but it's the Enlightenment, you know, story that truth about, and just for our listeners, you know, truth is a statement about fact, about reality. Reality is that which truth is about. So, you know, the modern definition of myth is that, you know, well, only historical, rational, empirical, and scientific truth about reality. That's it. Yeah. And that's a very true way of looking at things, but it's limiting truth to only one kind of truth epistemologically. We can only know how we know what is true through those ways. And as you said, you know, it's more true to see mythos as part of that. And in fact, the word mythology, as you know, it combines mythos and logos together. And a truly mythological worldview would include not only the modern empirical, rational, materialistic ways of knowing truth, but the supernatural, the poetic, the truth while non-literal ways of knowing truth. And that's what mythos really means. And in fact, it does disturb a lot of my students. I say, well, tell me what myth is. And they say, oh, well, that's just, you know, false, you know, not worth your time. I said, well, what if I told you the opposite was true? And they just look at me like I've, you know,
like you had two heads.
Exactly. I'm like, well, let me explain. And sometimes I snag them, sometimes I don't. But yeah, it's an imaginative way, an indirect way of communicating truth. That's what myth does. It's a narrative form. In fact, as I hinted at earlier, today myth is connected to the concept of worldview. Alistair McGrath, who's a scholar I really respect, who's reaching out to a lot of postmodern Christians, you know, in fact, that myth is a narrated worldview. It's our propositional, philosophical views of various things, but expressed in narrative form. Yeah. And we all live inside that.
Yeah. And when some of the characters in that narrated form are supernatural beings like God, that doesn't invalidate the trueness, you know, of the narrative. You know, it's actually more inclusive. It's more complete. You know, you have in the book at one place, you say Lord of the Rings is not an intentional allegory of the biblical story. Rather, the Lord of the Rings, the Hobbit, and the Silmarillion contain the same mythos, the same story of reality as the Bible. And that is a story for everyone. In saying that Christianity is the myth that came true, Tolkien was saying that Christianity is a narrated view of reality, but with one crucial difference. The Christian myth really happened. It is the really real, which I like the turn of phrase there.
Oh, thank you.
And your last line is the Christian myth corresponds accurately with all of reality as humans experience it, which I think is really an important thought. This sort of bleeds into another thing. This is the last thing I'm going to ask you before we actually get into the book content.
Sure.
And that is just, this is sort of an opinion question about the importance of re-enchantment. Now you allude to, you know, and use that vocabulary. And again, this audience is going to appreciate that vocabulary, but why do you think this is crucial for postmodern apologetics, or just to try to articulate what's really real to a postmodern audience?
Well, I think in particular, you know, we have to remind ourselves that postmodernists think we're all living inside stories that are only true for that community. There is no objective total, or what they might say, totalitarian truth, or a totalitizing narrative that scares them. But what you do when you do that, of course, is you take away the meaning of the word true. And so to appeal to a person who is, you know, is right. that statement true? Okay, whoa, students are like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Well, okay, I think the fear for postmodernism is a reaction to modernism as we know in the Enlightenment in particular, but also Epicurus back in the day, is that, you know, the modern understanding of truth was restricted to rational, empirical, scientific, and they were reacting to that. But I don't think postmodernists, to their credit, are against narratival truth. And so I think that's how we have to speak to them. I know Dr. Marco says in his Apologetics for the 21st Century People, has a great book that deals with this. And we have to meet them on their ground and say, okay, well, look, we're all living inside a story. So nobody can propositionally, rationally prove 100% that this story is true. But we can, and this is me drawing on McGrath, as I've done a lot, tell a better story. A lot of people are saying this today in the scholarly world. And that involves having explanatory scope and power and the ability to, here's a thing I mentioned in the book, your worldview, your myth, that is, has to be able to explain the existence of other worldviews. If it can't do that, it's not a very good worldview. It leaves out a crucial part. I mean, how does it, tell a story about the other stories? And I don't think Buddhism does that, or even Islam. I think Christianity does. And that's a different conversation. But I think we can show that Christianity is a better story. And that means to re-enchant. Re-enchantment, I'm using this. A lot of scholars are using it today. Paul Gould, in his Cultural Apologetics book, you know, defines it as putting the transcendence back into the world. And I think that's the right meaning.
It's really important.
It is, yeah.
It's really important. You know, and it just struck me, you know, now that a couple of weeks ago we had an Old Testament scholar, a friend of mine, John Hilber, on to talk about ancient Near Eastern, you know, Old Testament cosmology and the idea of divine accommodation. You know, that God picked people to write the Bible and let them communicate what he wanted communicated in the, you know, through the means by which they were capable. You know, and that creates disconformity with the way we would think about the world, but that really doesn't matter. But the only way that you can see through that or past that, you know, alleged impasse to, you know, the Bible being true is to get away from literalism and to start thinking in metaphor. You know, and that is also true right here. Because the only way you're going to be able to show that the Christian story is the best, you know, the best telling of actual reality, the best telling of that story that we can get is to be able to escape, you know, from a slavish literalism and start thinking in metaphor and archetype, because that's how stories are made. That's how they're done.
Yep.
You know, and if you can do that, if you can sort of escape from the reflex literalism and be able to have a conversation about these things, it is much easier to connect, you know, to not only postmodern, you know, audiences, but anyone who's capable of thinking about theology as story.
Agreed.
It that just hit me here, because again, we had John on real recently and it's just really important.
So well, important.
I want to get into specifics here. And again, I'm going to basically ask you to summarize each chapter. I'm going to start with I'll start with the title, and then I'll jump into a few, you know, questions here. But we're going to track through the book this way. I think that's an easy way to get through the material, and also in a reasonable amount of time, because there's a lot in here.
Oh yeah.
Chapter one, you entitle The Lord of the Rings as Parable, and the subtitle or the first section header is Allegory, Parable, and Fairy Story. So can you briefly define those terms, you know, and how does something like fairy story connect to parable?
Yes, I can. We'll start with the definitions. So I did a lot of research on this, and I owe a great debt to a lot of scholars that have book-length treatments on these terms, and I know this will not please everybody, but I have come to the conclusion through these, you know, especially Tolkien. That doesn't happen. Especially right. Tolkien scholars, my God, with this first term. So allegory, like parables, you know, two Greek words to speak of something else or to speak of another. And so a story that speaks of one thing in terms of another. I see, and a lot of scholars have said this, so it's not just me. It's a substitutionary story, you know, this for that. And it's very clear. And so you think of Bunyan with the Pilgrim's Progress, was it? I think I'm getting it mixed up with Lewis's Regress. He has the giant named Despair. Or you think of, you know, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I think to Lewis's credit, the rest of the six other books are less allegorical. But, you know, the children or daughters and sons of Adam and Eve. That's a very clear example of allegory. This for that. It's substitutionary. And yet, parable almost means the same thing. It has, you know, literally the word parabolein means something a little different, but it has this same connotation of resemblance or speaking of one thing as another, seeing as I know John Crossan has called it back in the day, seeing as. So parabolein means thrown from the side or to cast alongside. And I had one scholar, I can't remember who put it that way, but I like the definition of the Greek. Both of these are Greek words. You know, thrown from the side implies it's an indirect communication, which is narrative. And that's what allegory is too. So far, they're not very different. And I'll get into how they're different when we tie all this together. I'll wait to speak on that. The next one is a fairy story, and then we'll connect it to parable, and that'll have me kind of talk about all the terms together. Fairy story, I drew, of course, heavily on fairy stories, which was, I think, 1939. University of St. Andrews lecture that Tolkien gave. It became an essay. And he says, fairy contains many things besides elves and fae, besides dwarves, witches, trolls. It also holds the seas, the sun, the moon, the sky, the earth, and mortal men when we are enchanted. Well, fairy cannot also be caught in a net of words. It is one of its qualities, he says, to be indescribable, though not imperceptible. It's a metaphysical story. It's also a story of seeing as, but most broadly, I think fairy story is a story about everything. It is truly a myth. It is a metaphysical story that contains the mundane, the transcendent, the supernatural, the physical. And that's what Tolkien means. It contains things that are real to our imagination, but also to our faculties of reason. It appeals to the romantic in us, but also the rationalist in us, which is what Tolkien had to work on Lewis about. As you probably know, Lewis struggled with that. So the connection between fairy story and parable, I owe a great debt to Father Robert Murray, who is a Jesuit scholar and friend of Tolkien's, who wrote an essay in 1992 called Tolkien and the Art of the Parable. And I started on my research kick when I saw that, and I said, you know, this makes sense to me. I know that Tolkien's way was not to be very heavy-handed and to sermonize, and I think that's why he never mentions parable in explicit connection with fairy stories. But I do a lot of math, in a sense, to kind of show in the book through his letters and comments, and this is the best way I can kind of conclude, is that I argue that Tolkien had a spectrum of allegory, different kinds of allegory, and on the one side he had what he called and disliked very much the conscious and intentional allegory, which has, as we might say, more allegorical direct language in it and less suggestive language that would be metaphorical language. And so it's very in your face and it's very this for that, very substitutionary. On the other end of the spectrum of allegory, I think you can safely say that parable is a type of allegory, or the other way around. It really ends up being, I think, the same thing, but I submit parable is another kind of allegory, but it's on the opposite end of the spectrum. Exactly. And it is, in technical terms, I would say, contrary to the conscious allegory, it is less allegorical. Of course, it's allegorical. It has to be, but it's more metaphorical. Now, the difference is there. You know, scholars have argued that metaphor is speaking of one thing in terms of that are suggestive of another. And that's where the strength of the parable slash fairy story comes in. allegory is speaking of one thing clearly and directly in terms of, yeah, of another.
Nobody has to ask what you mean.
Exactly. Like, what? Could you explain? Yeah, no. It's yeah, very like, clear.
And your example from Lewis is good. You know, sons of Adam, yeah, daughters of Eve. What is that?
Right.
I mean, nobody's asking what that means.
No, not
it's,
at all.
Because it's so overt.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good word.
Then you move down the other direction, you know, you get to the less and less and less and less overt, but still similar.
Right.
Still tracking.
That's right. And so fairy stories and parables, to leave kind of the model, the mental model I just gave you, the connection, there's a lot. I would say one of the great points of correlation between parable and fairy story, which again are on that better end of the spectrum, is the way that the author shifts from the allegorical familiar mode that, you know, is very clear to breaking down the allegorical correspondences. And so for an example, you know, when Aragorn really looks like and resembles Jesus in the book, but not quite, or that mm-hmm. really sounds like the moral argument, but not quite. And you have these moments, and it's when Tolkien as a master storyteller or parable teller shifts from the allegorical to metaphorical mode. And I think that this is how he talked about fairy stories. And there's just so many other connections I could talk about. I know you want to move on.
It's interesting because it would seem that if you're trying to work the other end of the spectrum, the less overt, you want the reader to think, well, that sounds like, but now wait, you know, I mean, there's like this moment of hesitation.
Yes, exactly.
There's this moment of uncertainty. So if you can get your reader to think that thought, well then, okay, mission accomplished. You know,
exactly.
Move on to the next thing.
That's
you
right.
Know, and so, you know, all that you're saying is that this was a strategic decision. It was an intentional decision, you know, rather than to spend the time on the left mm-hmm. end or the, you know, the far end of the one end of the spectrum. Now we move to the other end, and
right.
we want to put enough in there so that people sense the similarity, mm-hmm. but they know that it's not quite.
Exactly. And I think Jesus's parables do the same thing. I mean, we know there are many echoes. You know, man had two sons. I mean, we think of a lot of people in the Hebrew Bible about this, and it reminds us of not just, you know, Abraham, but so many others. And so I think, you know, there's an echo of familiarity. It's a lure that brings us in, making us think we've heard this story before, and then it goes and it veers in a different direction. And when we get into the later chapters in the book, I can comment more on that, where that example of the breakdown is really clear. And for the Tolkien scholars out there, you know, that what that shows is that, no, this is not a sermon. This is not a this for that. But the vision is still there. The Christian worldview is very clear, and Tolkien was very explicit in his letters. We're lucky that he was.
Yeah, I mean, if you can ask the question, well, is this the point of the similarity? You know, or in other words, there could be lots of points of similarity here, and these mm-hmm. are here, and these aren't.
Right.
You know, and again, in biblical studies, you know, like mm-hmm. there's a man with two sons. Okay, and you just brought that up.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I actually got a question in a Q&A last night about the John chapter 4, the woman at the well with Jesus. Mm-hmm. You know, is this typological of, you know, other marriages between sons of God? Like, you know, okay, the search for a wife for Isaac. You know, he's the seed of Abraham. You know, and you know, some of these biblical characters where they go and they, you know, they get wives and the women, you know, somehow have a role to play in the messianic story and whatnot. So mm-hmm. the question was, you know, is John chapter 4 doing this? And there's enough there that makes you ask the question.
Sure.
But there's also enough disconnects there that make you wonder, that's probably not what it's about. You know what I mean? So there's this,
I do. Yeah.
There's this back and forth, you know, of what's going on. And, you know, it just seems that, that's really, again, what that sums up, you know, kind of what you get with Tolkien. You know, there's enough there to make you ask the question. And since it is there, you can't wipe the suggestion off the table.
Mm-mm.
Okay, you can't eliminate it, but there's these other dissimilarities as well. And he was content, and that's probably the wrong word. He probably enjoyed, mm-hmm. you know, seeing those sorts of discussions come out. And maybe wink at you and say, yeah, you're onto something, but.
Yes,
you know.
Exactly. Yeah, and I'm sure Jesus did too, which is why I try to envision that. There's also, what I would say, I mean, you know, Tolkien's comment about it being indescribable fairy, but not imperceptible. That's a great summary.
Yeah, that is a good summary.
You know, I love that explanation that he gives. And that's, well, there's enough on the table, as you said, but then it's taken away. Brant Petra, a Catholic scholar, has worded it kind of that the parables, the art of the parable, conceals and reveals. I think you mentioned that too in the Unseen Realm. I'm pretty sure you had at least strongly hinted at it. And it gets into the messianic plan being concealed, as you said. And I think you're right on the nose there. So Go ahead.
Finish your thought.
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, one of the other, for listeners who are familiar perhaps with Tolkien's fairy story, is the presence of the Yew catastrophe, which was a very, I wish I had talked more about it, but I do mention it. The moment of decision is how Murray puts it in his essay about Tolkien's Art of the Parable, but it really means like a denouement, you know, an outcome or resolution of the story, a moment of decision where something momentous happens. And we see that in the fairy story, conception of the fairy story, and also in Jesus's parables.
Yeah, and it could be something disastrous as well, but on the other side, there's this a blessing. Yeah, there's a good outcome.
Exactly.
You know, think the biblical studies audience, think of the day of the Lord. There's two sides to that coin. Yes, you know, all that's wicked will be, you know, judged and destroyed and undone. But the flip side of that is the righteous are vindicated and we get the new heaven and new earth, you know. So
that's right.
You know, it's this two Yew catastrophe. I don't know. Did Tolkien coin that term?
He did. And discatastrophe, I think he also coined. I just read that the other day. I didn't focus on that. But yeah, it was one that he coined in the essay on fairy stories. That's right.
Yeah, it's just an interesting way to put it. So let's drift into chapter two, because that's also about parables. And the title for chapter two is Parables Are Good News Stories. And then the first section header is Parables as Already and Not Yet Stories. And that's going to be real familiar language to this audience. So how are parables good news stories and already but not yet stories?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite chapters. And then, you know, we get into the Tolkien stuff more specifically in chapter three. But, you know, the good news is, as I'm framing it in the book, that the king has returned. He's begun to inaugurate or has inaugurated the kingdom of heaven, bringing the presence of Eden back to earth, as you put it. And yet the work is not complete yet. We still await the new heavens and the new earth of Revelation 21. And you go back to Isaiah 25, that kind of looks to that, I think, Isaiah 65. So I know you are familiar with this, and many of your listeners are. How are parables good news / already but not yet stories? Well, I mean, I think we can see this with a few examples. I just picked out a couple that I had mentioned in the book. I mentioned several others where I can think of contours of this, but we see the already and not yet, and I'm just talking of Jesus's parables here, in Matthew 25. You know, you get the whole chapter there, parables of the 10 virgins and the talents or bags of gold. You have the element of, you know, something happening, an announcement, but then having to wait a long time before the wedding banquet, or servants having to give an account. That's a challenging parable for how they use their time before the return of the king.
I think, just look at those elements. It's right there.
It's right there.
It just lays it out.
Yep, very clear, I think. And Mark 1:15, while not a parable, the opening of Mark's, our earliest gospel, probably, you know, repent, change your mind, turn your mind, turn around, believe the good news, is at hand. Jesus is saying, I mean, that's a present, an already announcement. But as we know from the rest of Mark and the other gospels, that there's a not yet portion of it. Jesus talks about going away, and the Gospel of John. And then coming back and preparing a temporary place, I think, in the famous, was it John 14 or 15?
Talk I go that he to gives. Prepare a place for you. Yeah.
It's a temporary place, an interim state between now and the new heavens and new earth. So I think we could have a lot of fun finding where these elements are present in the parables of Jesus. How do I connect that to the parabolic novel, as one scholar has called Tolkien's book? And how is the Lord of the Rings in particular, but the rest of the mythology, an already and not yet story? Well, I think I summarize this later in chapter three more clearly, but maybe it is in chapter two, but page 108, 109, you know, we have the announcement that the king has returned from the eagle at the end of the Return of the King. Something has happened. Mm-hmm. Your king, very clear language, your king is returning to you. He will be with you all the days of your life. And yet we know that's not true. Aragorn dies in the appendix. Spoiler alert, I guess. sorry, folks.
Stuff not to put in the movie.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Although, you know, in the last one, it's alluded to. So, you know, not too much of a spoiler.
I think Arwen has a vision in the movie, the extended edition, right?
The extended version.
Oh, I love those. So the news, you know, and I'm drawing on NT right here, you know, only makes sense in the longer story, which I'm saying is the story of Arda and the story of the Numenoreans and the dwarves and the elves and the whole story. And that kind of corresponds or resembles the story of Israel. And then that news transforms the present moment and looks to the future. And we see that Aragorn's coronation. Well, first, the announcement of the eagle, the coronation, then the discovery of the sapling of one of the trees that was originally in Valinor, which is like Eden in Middle Earth. And then
isn't that interesting? There's a branch. Isn't it? The branch imagery. Yeah. You know, it's messianic. You know,
oh, very much. And the whole imagery from Revelation about the two trees being back in and the two trees in Tolkien's Valinor, you know, in the original conception. So, I mean, there's a lot of connections there. And there we have the already and not yet. And there's a lot more to say, but that's an answer, I think.
I mean, for our purposes here, you know, in our audience, I mean, just here are the takeaways, both as on the biblical side and then the Lord of the Rings side. I mean, next time you read through the parables, you know, or through the Gospels and you hit parables, ask yourself if you can see already and then an interim and a not yet element. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're going to see this a lot.
Oh, yeah.
This already but not yet theme. So there's something happening, and then there's something going on, you know, like boots on the ground, you know, right now. And there's this accountability factor in a lot of them. And then the not yet comes into view.
It's very cool.
This is frequent. The parables are about the kingdom. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, most of the parables have this as at the very least a touch point, but a number of them are specifically oriented to this. So try to read them as already but not yet stories. And then, you know, when you're thinking about Lord of the Rings, it mimics it. It mimes, you know, that whole approach to, you know, telling the story. So, you know, again, you went into you know, some examples already, but that idea, I think, if this audience can take one thing away from this interview, and hopefully you can take away more, but that would be it.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you're approaching both the parables, and then when you think about not only Lord of the Rings, but I mean, you'll have other literature do this, but specifically Lord of the Rings, this is really the answer to the question of how is the Lord of the Rings about what Jesus' parables are about.
That's right.
That's it. In a nutshell, that's it. What we just commented on.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Chapter 3, again, is really when you take a deep dive into the content. The title is The Lord of the Rings is Good News. Mm-hmm. And again, the first section header is Your King Shall Come Again. So you devote space in this chapter to perhaps the most obvious connection to the gospel story of Jesus and Lord of the Rings. And you've already brought up Aragorn. So there's Aragorn. He's the cryptic, hidden in plain sight king, you know, who would return to claim the throne of Gondor. And of course, the famous line, the crownless again shall be king.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk about how the return of the king connects to Jesus in a few other ways?
Sure. I want to point out, though, too, there's a lot in the movies, and maybe I can integrate some of that into my talk through the next couple chapters. But the thing I want to say now before answering that is that we have to kind of assume the Luke 24 perspective. And I talk about this in my book. Hermeneutically, you know, we want to look back from in the Gospels, the risen Jesus, and search the scriptures in that sense. But I'm suggesting that Tolkien suggested in his letters and hinted at this, that is also the proper way to see the whole integrated mythology and how to answer this question greatly is how the return of the king and the Lord of the Rings reminds us totally about Jesus. We only notice this if we read the Lord of the Rings first, especially from the end. Yeah. And look back. And in fact, for those of you that don't know, in the Unfinished Tales, which is a collection of, well, Unfinished Tales. I just realized
aptly titled.
How that was going to sound.
Right.
In there, there's the quest of Erebor, and there's a tale there that Gimli and Gandalf and the hobbits are talking after the Return of the King. It's not in the main books. And Gimli, he looks back from the Return of the King after Aragorn has entered and the eagle has said his piece, that all of these events going back to the Hobbit and even further back are strangely woven together. Very strangely. That's Gimli's words, right? And mm-hmm. I think that gives us that permission that we're only going to understand that the Return of the King is the message of the gospel, and we're going to see the connection if we assume that perspective. But now to your question, I think it's very clear if you are a Christian, but we can talk later about how it's not clear if you're not a Christian. But, you know, Aragorn and Jesus behave very similarly, in their respective stories. I talk about the Greek words parousia, which is a loaded one having to do with the second coming, erroneously, I think. I mean, it's misunderstood. Obviously, that's a teaching we believe in, but it's often misunderstood. Exousia, these Greek words mean royal presence or arrival and authority, respectively. And drawing on N.T. Wright's great research here, you know, again, that's who kind of got me started on this. I looked for examples of authority, and they're everywhere. I counted at least, and I think I just found another one, but 19 plus moments in The Lord of the Rings where Aragorn, like Jesus, you know, and no one dared ask him another question from that day. Like in Matthew 22, when they ask him about David and the Lord, and Psalm 110, and Aragorn, I'm sorry, Jesus, we get him confused. Jesus just runs circles around them.
Shuts them down.
Oh, yeah. And then exhibits this incredible authority. And we see that in Helm's Deep when Aragorn just gets up on the ramparts in the books, mind you. It's not quite the same in the movies. And he just looks down and then dawn breaks, and, you know, all the orcs are just terrified at him. And the way Tolkien describes it, you definitely get that exousia and the parousia, the royal presence, the royal authority, and everybody's just terrified of him. There are subtler moments throughout the novel, you know, in the Fellowship, when the hobbits are sitting at Weathertop and Aragorn's telling them the story of his ancestors. Tolkien even describes the moon rising above the crown, keyword, of the hill behind his head. It's a very suggestive that, you know, this is a hill that's associated with his people. And, you know, we just get all of these very messianic Return of the King-like themes, and it reminds us of Jesus. And Jesus's parables are filled with these exiled and returning figures, or figures going away and coming back. So, I mean, there's just so many connections that I explore.
It is. It's really good stuff. I don't want to, I think to call it clever just is a little bit, I don't know, disrespectful. And it's more intelligent than just being clever.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you could tell that Tolkien knew his Christology really well, and really knew how to draw on it, you know, for things like this. Again, that, you know, granted, the average reader isn't going to pick up on everything, but they'll pick up on enough to draw them in, and then they'll start picking up more, and realize, like, oh wow, you know, it's hard to you know, go a few pages into anything about Aragorn and not run into something like this.
Even that's right, Dr. Heiser. Even the poem about Strider / Aragorn, you know, that's his Ranger Dunedain identity in the Fellowship. The whole poem is messianic. It reminds us of so many of the wisdom snippets of wisdom literature in the Old Testament, and just really redolent of that theme of the Return of the King. And it's been, I think, N.T. Wright most forcefully who has pointed out that, you know, we read as main text what the Gospels treat as presupposition. You know, the story isn't about how Jesus is divine and human. It's already obviously about that. It's about what that means is that God has become king. And what that means is a lot of other things. It talks about, of course, it points to what you talk about in your book about Eden kind of returning to Earth. And it's just such a, the way it all comes together. He really was brilliant. As you said, he knew his Christology. Mm-hmm. He knew his Bible, and he knew his Psalm 82, Deuteronomy 32 worldview. I mean, he understood the divine counsel, and we'll get to that, I know.
Yeah, I'm in the Silmarillion now, and it's just like...
It's everywhere. Oh, it's everywhere.
Right. It is. Yeah. Say a little bit about the wedding of Aragorn mm-hmm. and Arwen. You say a few things about this in the book or in this chapter. How does that connect to the gospel parables and
sure.
what we're talking about?
So briefly, you know, it resembles the language found in scripture, as Jesus as the bridegroom and the church or Israel, as the bride. And throughout the Bible, this is language, not just the monarchical language, but God is not just king. He's also bridegroom. It's just from Sinai to Jesus and everything in between. It's very clear. You also have Jesus's parables that have wedding imagery. And of course, Jesus's strange comment to those not acquainted with the Jewish worldview about can the friends of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom is with them? You know, some people just didn't get it. All of that language, I think, first points to the already portion. So in the Lord of the Rings, when you have Arwen and Aragorn marry at the end of the Steward and the King chapter in The Return of the King, it is, I think, first redolent of the first advent of Jesus and the marriage that he made on the cross to his people, the pledge to be with us and to reconcile us and call back the nations, but also pointing that he's going away and he's going to come back and he's going to, you know, come back for his bride. And so the wedding in the book, and there's a strange line, I may not have interpreted it properly, but I have to go back and look at it. And I don't think I included it in the book because I wasn't sure that I had it right, but it's something about, there's a line, I'll have to go find it. But Tolkien says something like, you know, there's a future element or they looked far off and almost like he's suggesting that this is not the end of the story. The wedding is just the beginning. There's more to the wedding in the future.
Does that have anything to do with you? This I didn't know, but you mentioned in the chapter that Tolkien had planned a sequel.
Oh yeah.
You know, the new shadow. So does that, what was that about? And what connections do you see?
Does
that, you know, dovetail into this at all?
So in, I'm just looking on my bookshelf here. I think it's volume 12 of the History of Middle Earth.
Okay.
You have, The Peoples of Middle Earth is the title of the edition there, the volume, excuse me. And in it, he has, or Christopher Tolkien, his son, has a summary of his unfinished planned sequel, The New Shadow. And I think he probably had a plan to connect this, but that's not what it's about. And so there's no marital elements there. But I'll have to somehow look up the other thing and get back to you on that. But it is interesting. Anyway, The New Shadow is different. It is connecting with different points of, I think, Tolkien's Christian worldview and theology. First of all, it's like 13 pages long. It's unfinished. He stayed up one night till 2 a.m. kind of hitting his head against it and just realized, you know, it's not going to work. He's done.
Nice to know that could happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right. We don't know anything about that. He knows, we probably are familiar, but some of our listeners may not know that Tolkien credited Lewis with his encouragement to finish Lord of the Rings, but gosh, to finish a sequel to it, I just don't think it was in the cards. So in it, it tells an interesting, my interpretation is that the fourth age of Middle Earth, which is the one after the end of the Lord of the Rings and the one that is established with Aragorn's coronation, is what it's about. It's about 100 years after Aragorn's death, where he lays down, and Tolkien doesn't even say that he actually dies, but that's beside the point right now. 100 years after this, kids are playing orc games. People are just kind of getting bored with peace. It's a weird way of putting it, but really cool. And there's some kind of shadowy cult and plot, and then that's it. It's closed. Mm. You know, it's tantalizing, but what I think is that it shows. Oh, it so is. And it's a very historical, dualistic, Jewish way of looking at things. It's, we're still living in Arda marred, as he says later in another work. We're looking forward to Arda renewed, which is the not yet portion. And I think that a lot of Tolkien scholars have been mistaken to say that, you know, the king and therefore the incarnation has not arrived yet because, well, there it is. Look at the new shadow. Well, hold on a second. Yeah.
They need a good dose of biblical studies for that.
I think so. I mean, especially some of the ones I mentioned, I'm like, well, wait a second. That describes what life is like now. Jesus didn't solve all the world's problems. As you say in your book, you know, if he had done that, he would have had to erase his imagers. So he's not done yet. And anyway, I think it's very clear Tolkien knew about his second coming theology, but he doesn't draw on rapture theology, thank God. Like other educated, I think, very well-spoken theologians, Tolkien obviously was. He knew 1 Thessalonians 4, which I take a look at, 15 through 17, is not about being taken up into the clouds, but it's combining metaphors from the Greco-Roman and Jewish worldviews, and it's all about the king returning. And that is clearly, I think, on display there. And so we look forward to a time when people are not bored with peace and that the king is going to come back. That's hinted at in Aragorn's so-called death. And so I think we tie that all together and we have inaugurated eschatology on display here very clearly.
In chapter four, we'll move to chapter four.
Yeah.
Because we got two to go, but I only have one question here because this is something that I just would never have occurred to me. So the title is The King Beneath the Mountain. Okay, The King Beneath the Mountain, Seeing Thorin and Thinking Aragorn. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I've read The Hobbit. I've seen, of course, the films and whatnot. So the question is, when we see Thorin, how and why should we be thinking of Aragorn? Because this is something that I just didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe I'm just not into The Hobbit as much, but I didn't make that mental connection. So what?
Yeah,
you know, when we see, you know, Thorin, why should we be thinking of Aragorn? And what, you know, what's up with the dwarves and all this? What role do they play?
This is such a fascinating storyline. And for those of you that haven't explored them in the Silmarillion, I talk a lot about this in chapter 5 about the backstory of the dwarves. And it's really underappreciated. Few other reviewers of the book had pointed out that they really liked that I went into this story because we've heard a lot about the elves and the Numenoreans. Mm-hmm. And I do give more focus to the dwarves. And in doing so, I've kind of set myself up for failure to a lot of people allegorically. But of course, that's not what I'm doing. Well, if Aragorn is tied to Thorin, well, hold on a second. Aragorn's a Numenorean elf man. He's not a dwarf. So if Thorin is a type, like David is for Jesus, if Thorin is a type for Aragorn, which even the movies, Gandalf in the third Hobbit movie really makes clear when Thorin, like just an awesome scene where he comes out and says to battle and they all kind of run in and rush the enemy forces. And Gandalf says they're rallying to their king. It's very clear in that moment. You can see the glint in his eye. Gandalf is kind of looking to Aragorn. And so there's a good movie example there. So I suggest that we should be kind of looking at Thorin as a type for Aragorn as we do the House of David, in a sense, for Jesus and the kings there. But of course, this wouldn't be a great argument if it wasn't based on something Tolkien had said. Now, he was talking more about linguistics and philology here, but he says in a letter, 176, I do think of the dwarves like the Jews. And then he goes on to say, at once native and alien in their habitations, speaking of exile, and yet not fitting in, speaking the languages of the country, but with an accent due to their own private tongue. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's clearly for philology there, you know. And
the exile. Well, it's the exile theme, which is, mm-hmm. you know, it's once you hear it, it's kind of obvious, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can start making connections. And the two kingdoms of the dwarves, Erebor, the lonely mountain in the north, the Khazad-dûm or Moria, the Elvish word for it, in the south. Yep. And you think of Israel and you think of Judah. And then you also have this side by side with the Numenorean history. And so what I think is going on here is, no, there's a breakdown in correspondence typologically between Thorin and Aragorn because they're different races. But that's because I think Tolkien divided allusions and resemblances to Jesus and the House of David between the story of the dwarves and the Numenoreans. Because you see the two kingdom theme, the exile theme in both kings' backstories.
He divides Christology or Christological elements. They're not all with Aragorn either.
Oh, no.
You have some with Gandalf too. I mean, that's not tactically foreign. I mean, it. Mm-mm. He's not sticking everything on one character.
Right. But I think this is also something that gets overlooked, and it's very important. You know, I think mm-hmm. Jesus kind of scattered those typological allusions himself. And maybe Tolkien was drawing on the Beowulf author here, too. As a professor of Anglo-Saxon literature, this would make sense. But in any event, I think that we look at Thorin and the dwarves as the House of David and their indispensable role. Now, here's the great connection. Is that in the Quest of Erebor, Unfinished Tale, that story about Gimli that I mentioned earlier, of everything being strangely woven together, Gandalf has a line where he says, if it wasn't for Thorin and I and the dwarves and Bilbo, then Smaug would have been unleashed on Rivendell. Now, for readers, you don't know this if you don't peer really closely, but Aragorn was in Rivendell during the events of The Hobbit, and he was only 10 years old.
Okay, that's right.
Now, here's what's really cool, are two things. I think it's Isaiah 42. There's a prophet. The prophet mentions something about hiding. It seems he may be speaking of the Messiah in his quiver. And I kind of, that just reminded me of that, the hidden Messiah, the messianic secret. Aragorn was hidden from the enemy. But there's also, what was I going to say there about the movie? I think maybe it's the third movie of The Hobbit.
It's the extended version. You get, you know, Aragorn, you know, he kneels at the statue of his mother and, you know, all that. You get a little bit more of the backstory.
Yeah. But in The Hobbit film, too, you have Thranduil, Legolas's dad, tell Legolas that, you know, there's a king, there's somebody important in Rivendell you need to go meet. And that's kind of a neat connection as well. So anyway, that's how I see it all together. And so I talk about a lot of interesting things here in this chapter about how the dwarves paved the way in the way that the Jews did, obviously, for Jesus to be descended from the line of David, like Romans 1, Paul says. So that's how I put it together.
All right. Last chapter is just simply named Estelle, which of course is the, I guess the Elvish word for hope. So at one point, prior to this chapter, you know, I can't remember what chapter it was, but you wrote that from 2 years to 20, Aragorn's identity was kept secret and he was given the name Estelle, okay, which means hope. So what you just talk a little bit about how, I mean, the fact that this is his given name, how does that, you know, play out? Like, how does that statement in, you know, earlier in your book sort of take shape in this last chapter?
Well, in chapter 5, what we're seeing is that I've reached back from the return of the coronated King Aragorn all the way back into the ancient past of Arda, of Middle Earth. And we're back in the first and second ages now. And what I try to explore here and what the hope refers to here is in a debate between Finrod, who's an Elvish king and the brother of Galadriel, who readers and listeners will know who that is, Kate Blanchett from the movies, and Andreth, who's a woman who was infatuated with Finrod. And this debate is very Job-like dialogue, in fact. In that dialogue, which is an late 1950s work, after The Lord of the Rings was finished, Tolkien wrote The Debate of Finrod and Andreth. And in it, he has Andreth mention that by the first age, which is historically in Middle-earth when this debate takes place, there was already something called the Old Estel, or Hope, of Ilúvatar, God, entering into his creation. And then secondly, Finrod, at some point in the dialogue, and I go over this in Chapter 5, says that he doesn't think it will be, he doesn't even mention the dwarves, he doesn't even think it will be the elves who will be the saviors of all, but a man. And, you know, more true than he realized. Finrod is also connected, this goes real deep, to Beren, who is an ancestor of Jesus. And anyway, there's a lot of twists and turns here. But Finrod and Beren is a man who's an ancestor of Aragorn. Finrod, I think, saved his life in the dungeons of Sauron. So there's a history here. This is the man that I think predicted, or rather, typologically, when we look backwards, it seems he did. You know, the prefigured would be the better word. The Messiah coming into Middle Earth, understood as the return of the king. And I explore that. And the hope, Estel, again, refers to not only Aragorn, which that's the name he's given, but that reference should make us go back to this debate and think that's what Tolkien was referring to. And so I think it's very significant that this debate takes place in the First Age, right on the eve of one of the great six or seven battles that the people were having with the first Dark Lord, Melkor, or Morgoth. Mm-hmm. And it's already an old hope by this point, which means that this is something God had been planning, like we know in the Bible, from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you devote space in this chapter to discussing a number of points of emphasis that I have in Unseen Realm, you know, because, you know, it gets into the cosmology, the Cimmerillion, you know, all of that content. So, you have elements here of divine counsel, supernatural rebellion, redemption, adoption of humans and children of God, or, you know, the whole, you know, Ilúvatar and Tolkien's, you know, terminology. So how, just generally, how do you see those concepts sort of coming through in Tolkien's cosmology and the figures he has there?
Let me just give a few examples. So with a great deal of respect for your work, that I'm so grateful that it's changed my understanding of my faith. So thank you. But because of your research in this department, I couldn't help but make these connections and see them on display. And I thought, wow, it's clear now that with up-to-date scholarship, we can dismiss the old arguments for the Ainur, the Valar, and the Maiar, and the Silmarillion, who are these previously thought to be either or combination of these, the divine aspects of the one true God, his multiple aspects, which, you know, you dismiss or argue against in your Unseen Realm book, or that there are references to the Trinity, which I think is just patently false and obviously not in the Bible either, or that they're angels or archangels. They're not. They're God's divine counsel, and there's they're hierarchical. You have the Valar, who are kind of the like the senior sons of God, council members, and the Maiar, like Gandalf and the Balrogs, who are the lower divine council. And I think now, and I think some scholars are waking up to this. I know Dr. Marcos has seen it too. I don't know too many that have pointed this out. In fact, the ones I read, nobody said that it reminded them of Psalm 82. And that's why, you know, I'm like, it's right there.
Yeah.
This is the divine counsel. And
I mean, you can't see it if you, oh, the gods here are just men. If you're thinking that, you'll never see it.
Yeah. And nor are they Jewish elders or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So exactly. So that's one. Obviously, the divine counsel is on full display. And the unseen realm is quite obvious. Just in general, Tolkien had a supernatural, a fully fleshed out Christian worldview, the supernatural aspect of the created order, not Platonic, disconnected, disembodied. It's here, the transcendent dimension of the world we live in. And so obviously, Tolkien includes that assumption in his books. Evil, you've got, I think, the biggest connection that I saw from your demons book had to do with the Melkor rebellion in the Silmarillion and its infection of other divine council members. Now, in Tolkien's universe, you have Melkor, who's a Valar, the supremely powerful Valar, who starts weaving his own music. The world comes into existence through music. Beautiful. And little do we make this connection, but he infects or influences negatively Aule, who is the creator of the dwarves. And fun fact, the dwarves were created first, but they were put to sleep because it went against God's plan. Well, I made the connection to the Genesis 6 passage here about the corruption.
And you also get, you know, with Aule, there's a direct connection to craftsmanship, you know, which you get in the whole Sons of God Watchers. You know,
yes, exactly.
Thing in Second Temple Judaism, it's just there. It's all there.
It's very clear. Yeah. So that's the highlight I wanted to point out. The privatio boni Augustinian doctrine of evil, origin of evil, is very much there. I know Thomism is beyond me, but I know Aquinas is a great influence as well on Tolkien's worldview as a Catholic. There have been better books that explore that, but I think, obviously, we see that explanation of the origin and nature, metaphysical nature of evil on display in the Ainu Lindale, the creation myth. So that's very clear.
Yeah.
And
I found it interesting. You know, and I can't remember who the author is right now because I just bought it. I'm only a first chapter into it, but there's actually a whole, it's an academic work, an academic press on Tolkien's cosmology. Yeah, this is something I'll be drilling down into because the more I, you know, through Lewis, you know, initially and now, you know, your book, it's like, well, I could camp out here for a while.
It's a lot of fun. It is.
And I think, you know, for me, I mean, I often get asked about, you know, what are the, about tools, you know, for doing biblical theology and, you know, we can give you, you know, nuts and bolts tools and books and resources and all this. But I honestly think that one of the best things you can have is imagination.
Oh yeah.
And that isn't, you know, to fictionalize, you know, the data points, but I think an active imagination helps you to sort of connect things in multiple ways. And then you essentially find out what hangs together. You know?
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, so it'll be useful for me for that.
Yeah, well, have fun. I'm so grateful you asked me on, and it seems like you enjoyed my book, and I know there's a lot in there, but thank you for...
Let me ask you one more question before we wrap up. Can you give us an example of how you would, or maybe you have used the content of Lord of the Rings to have a discussion with somebody who isn't a Christian? In other words, are there things in here that you've used or would recommend to use as discussion starters?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. It's a great question. All of this has been just the best interview. I've really enjoyed it thoroughly. So thank you again. I would leave you with 3 points, and I think these are my favorite parts of the questions today, if I had to pick, because they speak to the practical and apologetic usefulness of Tolkien's books. Now, first and foremost, it is a story in its own right. It needs to be considered and treated as an aesthetic object. However, with great caution and respect for the author and his intentions, I would submit these 3 things to start conversations, and they are conversation starters. The first one I've used was one that was used on me by Peter Kreft, the great Catholic scholar. And he wrote in his Philosophy of Tolkien, do you love the Lord of the Rings? Well, if the answer is yes, and I get this from a lot of my secular students, then I kindly and gently point out, well, you unconsciously love the Christian story. Here's how. And they go, what? And I go, well, let me explain. Did you know Tolkien wrote this? Do you know he wrote that? And are you familiar that the same thematic contours, creation, fall, redemption, restoration? And then I give him a second point here. This is related to the first. Here's a talking point, and the nerds that love and know the books, like me and you, that the Red Book of Westmarch in the Return of the King, when Frodo is giving a title to him and he and Bilbo's great journey story, he entitles it The Downfall of the Lord of the Rings and the Return of the King. And I say, there I submit to you is a summary that the story the Bible is telling, and the story we find here: creation, fall, redemption, restoration. Thirdly, and finally, there's a bit more of a philosophical starting point for those of us that like the rational apologetics. In The Two Towers, Book 3, Chapter 2, it's entitled The Riders of Rohan. Aragorn has a conversation with Éomer about his metaphysical naivety concerning the existence of hobbits, and it's a long thing. I don't want to get too into it. I know we're already running long, but Éomer says, "Do we walk into legends, walk on legends, or in the green earth in the daylight?" And Aragorn responds, "A man may do both." And so he says, "The green earth, that is a mighty matter of legend, though you tread it under the light of day." And here I get into a conversation with people about how some of the moral arguments and philosophical arguments of Christianity are present underneath Tolkien's fictional writing. So there's a lot to mine there. So that's a great place to go to have that conversation.
Well, that's good stuff. Yeah, I'm glad we could do this. I'm glad we had you on, and certainly thankful for your books. So we will have a link, obviously, to where people can get your book on the episode webpage. And just thanks again, it's very evident that you not only put a lot of work into this, but it's more than an academic enterprise. It's personal.
Yep.
And I think that's going to come across, in the book. And for those who, love Lord of the Rings, this will be really, it'll be useful fodder to have discussions, but also you're going to learn a lot too, and be able to, you'll be stimulated to be able to think better even about, certain things in scripture too. Again, it just gives you little nudges in certain directions that I think are really an assistance there.
Thank you. This has been great. Thank you again.
Yep. Thank you.
All right, Mike. It's always fun to watch you because I know you're geeking out. You love this stuff. But Tolkien, I mean, he really is a master of Christology. I mean, he intimately knew that in order to weave it into his stories and whatnot. You really have to know something before you can really repurpose it the way that to the level that he did. And so that's what's fascinating.
Yeah.
I think what you find fascinating.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is. He's not just writing something and, can I drop something in here to make people think about Jesus? No, there's so much of it that is, again, parts of it are noticeable, but you, for every noticeable thing, you've got 3 or 4 things that you'd really have to drill down, and you'd have to know not only, the Lord of the Rings well, but you'd have to know the New Testament really well. So he knew what he was doing, for sure.
Did you ever watch the Hobbit, the 1977 cartoon movie?
I have not seen that. Oh, no, I've never watched it.
I saw it as a child, and it terrified me. I mean, it really did feel biblical in nature. Just the animation style of it and everything. It really did have that biblical feel for it. So I think I kind of got that early as a kid by watching that particular movie. It scared the crap out of me.
Well, I should watch it. Yeah.
It's good.
With that recommendation.
It's good. It really is.
Is that two thumbs up?
Yeah. I'd like to go back and watch it too. And have you watched the movie Tolkien, the based on his life?
No, I haven't seen that yet either. I mean, Drina has seen it and really recommended it. So I gotta watch that.
Yeah. It's good. So I need to go back and watch Lord of the Rings again. And with this mindset, it's kind of like reading the Bible after you read The Unseen Realm. You go back and you start to understand all these layers and it makes it more interesting. It really does.
Yeah. Well, that's an irresistible recommendation there. So I'll hope to do both.
All right. Well, hey, we have Michael's book. We've got a coupon code for his book. So go to nakedbiblepodcast.com, get the link. And Mike, well, the next week we're going to be getting into Revelation.
Yeah, we'll do an introductory episode like we do for all of our series, you know. But yep, we're taking the plunge. It begins next week.
All right. Awesome. It's finally here. All right. Well, with that, I want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.